Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Investigate Europe podcast. My name is Sindhuri Nandakumar. After Russia's invasion of Ukraine in late February, European countries responded by acting like one. The EU is sending arms to Ukraine and has introduced historic sanctions to cripple the Russian economy. Germany announced that it would spend 100 billion euros to boost its defense. Finland and Sweden, known for their neutrality usually, are discussing NATO membership, while nearby Denmark wants to be a part of EU defense initiatives. Now, it might look like this unity has come out of the blue, but it hasn't. For years now, the EU has been building its military and defense structures that can be used both inside and outside the Union. But the whole while, there has been very little transparency or debate in the public sphere. So, is all of this going to make us safer? Investigate Europe's reporters have spent months researching the European military complex and how a change in stance and policy over the years has seen the rise of defense contracts, arms exports, and the willingness to consider a common military force. And during this research, they had to adapt to the current events in Ukraine that changed the dynamics and maybe in some ways also the essence of their research. So to discuss this investigation and its findings, I have with me two guests. Ingeborg Eliasson, based in Norway, who is coordinating IE's investigations, and Paula Pena, reporter for Portugal, who is the head researcher for the military issue. Ingeborg and Paula, welcome to both of you.
Hi, Sindhu. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Sindhu.
Thank you both. And I just want to start with a very broad and general question, which is, we know that this issue that you're investigating is super relevant, given what's happening in Ukraine. How are you coping with working on such a dynamic, ever-changing issue that has really taken the world by storm?
Well, it's been a ride. We initially thought that we were looking at issues that moved relatively slowly. We were, of course, aware for much of the time that the Russian were having military buildup on the borders of Ukraine, but we could not imagine what would actually happen. Then a month before we were to be ready to publish, the Russian invasion forced us to see everything we had found through this lens. And that took a lot of effort.
If we were to get into the details of it, Ingeborg, how has this invasion of Ukraine by Russia, how has it shed light on the EU's approach to the idea of its military and defense structures?
Well, this, for most people, sudden attack on Ukraine, you know, it's a war in our immediate neighborhood, and that had a shocking effect on our governments. And for a while now, they have been able to bury all their usual competing interests and have acted, as you said, as one. They have sanctioned Russia to cripple its economy and agreed on massive military aid to Ukraine to defend itself. And this is new because the EU is not a federation. It's not the United States of Europe. And most member countries also don't want that. So it's hard to see how you could have countries agree on a joint command structure in defense. And the EU treaty even says that the common EU budget should not be used for, as it says, measures having military or defense implications. But what we found is, of course, that this doesn't mean that this is not happening. The EU leadership has for years tried to develop a common foreign and defense policy for the Union, and the Russian war on Ukraine is helping the unity that this process really needs.
It looks like it happened overnight or out of the blue, and it hasn't. But it seems to me that at some point, the stance of these leaders, it switched, even though it might have happened well before. Could you speak a bit about how and why that happened, Paulo?
When we started to analyze the military question inside the EU, we had a lot of different important events that shed some light into the need of a military union. I'm talking about, for instance, the Trump presidency in the United States that, well, questioned a little bit the way the European Union was feeling safe only by a majority of its members belonging to the NATO force. This was important. Also, the Brexit was important, because the UK was a big military power inside the European Union, and now it's not anymore. But we had recent events like the Afghanistan leave last year, which also showed the way the need to organize some military union inside the EU was, it was urgent in a way. But These were all arguments that were being used while most of the things happened, well, I won't say in secrecy, but we have sources that tell us that it was very not transparent. It was very far away from the public scrutiny and also from the public debate. And that's also something that changed, because now the public debate is more about this than it was ever before.
In the case of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, this change of stance is hugely exemplified, right? We can see it, but I'm sure that these changes, incremental as they might have been, would have been obvious or would have played out before. So can you give us some ways in which these policies started to shift, or places where you could have really seen the impact of this change in position?
Well, could take the involvement in an area far away from, or relatively far away from Europe, which is a military engagement in Mali, in mm-hmm. the Sahel, in Africa. There is, so the EU countries have all agreed on rules that are meant to prevent arms being exported to conflict zones. And because it is very hard to control what these arms are used for and by whom in such situations. But this happens nevertheless in several areas of the world, as the rules are interpreted very differently by different countries. And EU countries that participate in an EU training mission of the army in the war-torn Mali, for instance, have also exported weapons to the country in parallel to this training. And this happens now in a new structure that is called the European Peace Facility, which is meant to strengthen the EU's influence in military conflicts outside the EU. It could be through military missions like the training of the Malian army, and it could also be with assisting such countries with military equipment. But until the Ukraine war, this equipment sent to fragile areas was so-called non-lethal. So that would be such things as medical equipment, or maybe field hospitals, or engineering equipment, or even money to renovate training buildings and that kind of thing. And this changed with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when the peace facility now has promised real weapons for the first time. First, a package of 500 million euros was agreed between the member states, and now the foreign ministers have agreed also to spend the same amount on another package, again with weapons to Ukraine.
Okay, so this might come across as a pretty basic question, but, you know, Ingeborg, you hinted at this too before, which is that technically the EU is not supposed to pay for war. Paolo, can you talk a bit on how it's circumventing these rules and managing to do everything that Ingeborg just outlined?
The question here, and while we were talking about transparency before, the question here is that most of the important decisions are taken in an intergovernmental basis, which is to leave the European Parliament, which in a democracy like the European Union should be the central place for having the debate. So the European Parliament is kept out of all these intergovernmental changes that were instituted by the Common Security PESCO agreement, and also the peace facility. And then the European Commission, with a little involvement of the Parliament, but we can talk about that if you want later, decided also to go ahead with some programs to assist and to fund the military research and development of projects. This is the basic way how the European Union is going ahead with the military engagement without changing the treaties or without having a common debate about the need for that. And this is basically it, leaving the Parliament in a very, very fragile scrutiny position and to advance with intergovernmental actions and with well-funded development and research projects.
You also write in your investigation about the role of non-state actors. So how a few players in the defense industry like Airbus and Thales, they play such an important role because in many ways they have very big pieces of the pie. And then many of them also owned in part, at least in part, by funds like Vanguard and BlackRock. So can you talk a bit about what this might mean, or whether these are causes for concern when it comes to issues like monopolies and lack of governance?
Yes, that's the main problem here, because when you have such a concentrated market or a market with such intertwined relationships between the main states like France, Italy, Germany, and Spain, the biggest states with military development, and state-owned companies that are at the same time owned also in important and relevant parts by investment funds, you create the perfect situation for a market that is not transparent, that is pretty much dependent on lobby. And because we should have it clear, these companies that are partly important, that have important parts that are state-owned, are also selling to state. So this is a very easy explanation for the lack of transparency and the problems that usually come when a market is so much dominated by big companies that are state-owned. What we found in our data-driven story in this part was that out of the 302 companies that received funding from the last fund that was approved by the Commission, 5 companies like Airbus, Thales, Leonardo in Italy, Indra, Sistemas in Spain, and Dassault, in different combinations and together with other companies, appear in 23 out of 41 projects. So they receive more or less 75% of the total amount of funding awarded by the European Commission. I'm not saying that the 75% goes to these 5 companies alone, but 75% of the money that the Commission was giving to develop the industry went to projects that had one or more of these companies. So this is something that we should pay attention to, because this is the most problematic thing. And in the part that we also analyzed of the involvement of the mainly American investment funds like BlackRock, Vanguard, as you said, this creates also another concern, which is the common ownership of the market, because these investment funds are also shareholders of the main rivals, American rivals of the European companies that produce the same kind of things like drones, for example. So what's the problem here? The problem here is that if a whole sector of the military industry has the same owners in Europe and in the United States, the incentive for competition is very low and prices usually go up, because we know from other researches in the past that, for instance, in the American aviation sector or in the banking system, this common ownership leads to a fragile competition and to prices being artificially set up very high.
Honestly, it feels like just this part could have been an investigation of its own, right? I'm sure it's super complex and you would have been really digging through information and data to break it down. One thing I want to know is, you know, just to switch gears back to the military and the EU. Now, the EU already has a rapid reaction military force, which I understand is not a very well-known thing by many, especially because it's not very active. And now there's word or there's a push for a more robust version of it. And it's in something called a strategic compass. What is this compass? And Ingeborg, can you talk a bit about why we should care about it and even know about it in the first place?
This compass is a political document, and the member states have just agreed on the text of it. It's an action plan to strengthen the EU's security and defense policies towards 2030. And it's been hammered out in the past 2 years with lots of people contributing to it. And it's been through many consultations and edits. And the curious thing is, of course, how the text was sharpened with the increasing Russian threat towards Ukraine and even after the invasion. So the previous formulations on the EU's relationship to Russia have been toughened up. And now the beef of the plan is concretely to establish an EU rapid reaction force consisting of 5,000 troops. This is not the first time there has been something that's supposed to be like common forces. There have been so-called EU battle groups, like you mentioned, Sindhu, since 2007, but they have never been deployed anywhere because there has been no agreement on how and when to use them. Now, this new force is something they have agreed on, and also they have agreed on exercising a lot more together. So the compass is a new attempt to build a common security and defense policy. But really, the question is the same. If the EU can have a real common defense policy without first becoming something like the United States of Europe with democratic checks and balances that are not there today.
That's exactly what was running through my mind as you were answering that question, which is that, you said that this is not the United States of Europe. That's not how it's been. But in your view, do you think that there will be a European army? And if yes, what are the arguments for having one?
Well, I think there will be more European cooperation within NATO. You know, it's happening, and the discussions mm-hmm. are what form and shape this might have. But they do practice a lot together. There will be more of this. But for now, these things are happening inside NATO, and for the foreseeable future, I guess that will be the case. Most countries feel safe in NATO, where the US has a totally overwhelming military capacity compared to the Europeans. But a European army, we asked the EU governments about this, and we didn't have that many answers. But out of the 8 answers we had, one government said that this is a long-term goal, and that was the German government. This is obviously not something that many other countries foresee at this point. But I think a lot will depend on what happens in Ukraine and what happens with the relationship between Russia and the EU. If that goes really bad, that may help those who also want a European army, I would think. And the main argument for such a joint command is that Europe may have very other security interests in Europe than the USA, which is far away geographically, and that therefore our countries need to be able to act without the Americans in some instances.
Paolo, you and your colleagues, you broke a story recently that the EU member states continued exporting arms to Russia even though there was an embargo after the invasion of Crimea. Juxtapose that with the sanctions and the huge displays taking place against Russia by the EU today. And it's kind of a bit of, it's like a paradoxical little bit. But firstly, can we start with talking about how this even happened? What are the legal systems in place that allow these exports to continue?
But the main problem here is a political problem, of course. We were analyzing the data for arms exports in each of our countries and the EU because there is a system, COARM, which is a working group in the Council that demands every member state to deliver the arms exports done by that country and the destination and the content, etc. And we were analyzing that huge pile of data. And we saw that after 2014, the European Union decided to institute an embargo on arms exports to Russia after the invasion of Crimea in July 2014. And we saw that after that, many countries, 10 countries, 10 member states of the European Union were still selling military equipment to Russia. And I'm not talking about dual-use military equipment. I'm talking about bombs, torpedoes, missiles, cars, ships, etc. So what we tried to understand was how could this happen with the embargo? And that's the legal part of it in your question. And the embargo has also a loophole because the embargo says that all the negotiations that have started before 2014 may develop into arms exports, even with the embargo. And that's what the majority of the governments claim, that these were not new sales, that these were sales that were agreed before the embargo. But here we heard lots of sources, and I remember one of them that pointed precisely to the big issue here, which is arms exports are not an economic sale. They are not just a regular commercial transaction. Arms exports are a political decision because we don't sell arms to countries that threaten lifestyle, our democracy, and that's the problem here. We still saw that countries like Italy were selling rifles to Russia in 2021. So I think this should lead to a debate in our countries about what's the policy for arms exports. And I'm not talking only about Russia. In the Portuguese case, I was overwhelmed and surprised by the amount of arms exports to conflict regions in the world. And I think this should be in the public debate because people don't really know what our our countries are selling and how important the military industry is in a very sensitive political aspect of our lives, which is this one.
Paolo, you and the team at Investigate Europe, you've surfaced a lot of issues that, like you pointed out, are not really widely discussed in the public sphere. And that highlights the importance of this work. Just from a more personal point of view, could you speak about what surprised you? Which of these many findings really surprised you as a journalist studying this issue?
That's a very demanding question, Signorina, because I was very surprised to see how France, Italy, Germany, the Czech Republic were selling arms to Russia. Of course, I didn't expect that because I knew there was an embargo. And I thought the embargo would just make the countries stop selling military equipment to Russia. But I was also very much surprised to see the power of the military industry in shaping this common military political decision that is being taken by the EU since 2014-15. So I was very much surprised to understand the effectiveness of the lobby in the military industry, being able to shape decisions like the commission funding for the development of military industrial projects, etc. And we try to understand several stories around these in concrete terms, which were the projects that got more funding and why. And one of them is the Eurodrone, which is a joint project with France, Germany, Italy, and Spain also. And trying to understand exactly why is this the most important military industrial project led by the big companies like Airbus, Dassault, Leonardo in the European Union. And it's very curious to understand how this is more or less a failed project that never was able to be developed by the countries themselves. And now is being supported by the European Union. And we did ask the European member states, the 27 European member states, what's their interest in a common Euro drone or a drone with military ability to participate in military actions. And the answers were also surprising because besides the four countries that are developing the project, none of the others that answered us told us that they wanted to buy the Eurodrone or they were interested in joining the consortium that is developing the Eurodrone. So this is the most expensive project being paid by the European Union, and you have four big countries interested in it, more to develop the industrial national companies inside their nations more than a common European use for it. So this was also very surprising.
I was also surprised by, you know, now that the EU, which is known as a, you know, it's an economic superpower and it has been known for its so-called soft force, soft power, and believing in soft power in the world. And now there may be reasons to build more hard power. There may be, but it's surprising how this is happening with the building of military muscle, how marginal the only real democratic structure of the EU has become in this development. I mean, it's about life and death, and very often also outside the European borders, and it should be scrutinized the more by the people elected to do that and by the public. Because it's happening in the name of the people belonging to the European Union.
Absolutely. And, you know, Ingeborg, that segues to my next question, which is based around what the European Ombudsman, Emily O'Reilly, said about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and how this has necessitated that the EU's military policies become more transparent. And I think what is sometimes easy to forget is that at the end of all of this big decisions are human lives that are at stake. And you've reported on all of these findings. And why do you think, because, you know, you are presenting these findings to citizens, why do you think, the both of you, that it's important for citizens to be a part of this discourse and for this public sphere debate to expand?
Yeah, I totally agree with Ingeborg. This is not some kind of policy that doesn't affect people's lives. This is probably the most important public debate that we should be having. And we should be having this debate, of course, it's natural with the conscience that many people now are suffering from a war. People are trying to rebuild their lives outside of their country. People We did that also, as we do always, to share what we are seeing in our countries related to the Ukrainian war. And we saw lots of things, important things, like the way volunteers are offering to help the people coming from Ukraine in the main train station in Berlin, or the way people are folding jackets and blankets in Portugal in huge boxes to send to Ukraine. That's a solidarity example, very interesting and very appropriate. But we see also the fear. In Warsaw, the pills, the iode pills, and sorry for my pronunciation, which is probably not the best one, thankful to the ombudswoman, Emily O'Reilly, who said that the transparency is essential in this kind of public debate. And I think our role there as journalists is precisely that one, to show what's happening for people to have a better knowledge and to be able to do their decisions in an informed way. Because if we are just deciding by what we see on social media, with the algorithm choosing all the inputs that we have to build our informed decision, that's not probably enough. And people need to go deeper into this kind of subjects to understand exactly what we are doing, because this will have a future effect. And our role as journalists is precisely that one, to give people the information they need to take their own decisions, whatever they are.
Absolutely. And thank you to Paolo and Ingeborg for being with us today, but also for just pulling off this big investigation with your team of colleagues. And we look forward to reading all your material that's up on our website at investigate-europe.eu. Thank you both.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.